Let me take care of you until the end of our days. How my heart swelled at his words. How tempting he was. How unreasonable and ungrateful I felt for my apprehension. But I simply couldn't help myself. How many years before we could join Papa in Virginia? William fell silent in a way that troubled me beyond measure. His thumb stroked the back of my hand. Finally, he swallowed and met my eyes. I cannot make my home in Virginia, Patsy. It took me a moment to understand his words, and even then I was left bewildered. The breeze caught my curls, and I brushed them away. You're a Virginian, William. Where else could you make your home? He looked at the sky for a long moment.
Somewhere else. Someplace in America where prosperity can be had without slaves. It cannot be done in Virginia.
That can't be true, I sputtered. Your practice at the law
would fail utterly, even if I didn't mind the drudgery of it.
He bolstered himself with a deep breath.
Perhaps you don't remember Virginia society because you've come of age in France. The gentry will never trust a lawyer who isn't also well established as a Virginia planter.
Then be a planter, I argued. Take a small farm, employ only sharecroppers.
I'd soon be a very poor, indebted planter who could in no way support the daughter of Thomas Jefferson in the manner to which she has grown accustomed.
I can grow accustomed to something else. He took my face in his hands and smiled.
If anyone could, it would be you. But I'm resolved. I'll never run a slave plantation. I'll never be a part of that evil. All Virginia is stained with it. My conscience won't allow me to make a home there, and yours shouldn't allow it either.
My confusion gave way to a slow spark of anger that took hold and began to smolder. And neither should Papa's conscience. That's what you're saying, isn't it? Staring hard, he said,
I wouldn't presume to judge your father.
A stinging pressure pricked at the backs of my eyes. You think he should free all his slaves?
I think he cannot free his slaves without impoverishing himself and his daughters.
William replied, his eyes filled with both sadness and understanding.
Without slaves, he'll have nothing. He'll lose it all, right down to the last book. He shielded you from this. But when your grandfather Wales died, your father inherited a portion of his debt, more staggering than we ever imagined. Your father has only this year learned the full extent of it, which is why he's eager to return home and deal with his creditors.
My mouth dropped open and I struggled for words. How could that be? For months now, my father had done nothing but lavish gifts upon me. New ball gowns, gold watches, and rings. That was to say nothing of the concerts and horse-riding lessons. This flurry of shopping started when I confessed my desire to join the convent. Had my father been so desperate to keep me with him that he'd driven himself into more dire financial straits? Guilt bit at me. Poor Papa! How can he satisfy the creditors?
William sighed. He'll have to sell land or slaves.
A wave of nausea swept over me. Surely not. Owning slaves was an evil, but selling them...
Patsy.
William forced me to look at him, his voice dropping an octave to meet the severity of his countenance.
When it comes to the evil of slavery, the only choice you'll ever have is in which husband you marry. I want to take you away from plantation life. The government doesn't enrich its ambassadors, but my salary will be enough. We'll scrimp and save enough to make wise investments in stocks and bonds. and that's what we'll live on.
I'd never heard of any man making his fortune this way. Every man of wealth we knew had built his fortune with land. All the Virginia gentry, all our friends in France. William had never sounded more like a wild-eyed radical. It was little wonder Papa thought he couldn't support a family. He must have seen that I doubted him.
When we return to America, we'll settle somewhere more in keeping with my moral principles. Philadelphia, or Boston, or New York. If you become my wife, you may have your pick.
He gave a small smile.
We'll visit your father in Virginia as often as you like. I'd never keep you from him. But I can never settle near Monticello, as he's pleaded with me to.
His voice was firm. There was no crack or waver in it to give me hope he might change his mind. And I shook my head at a complete loss. The sun and the bird's song upon the breeze suddenly seemed to mock my predicament. I would never leave you or my country but for God, I'd said to my father. Was love for William to make a liar of me? What you're asking!
He drew my hands to his lips, beseeching me with his eyes. I'm asking you to make a life with me, not to abandon your duties as a daughter.
Then why did it feel like that's exactly what he was asking me to do? I passed through the days and weeks that followed in a confused haze, my thoughts preoccupied by my struggle to balance my heart's desire with my lifelong duty. That I was no closer to a resolution weighed on my shoulders like a wet wool blanket. One evening, I sat numbly at the dining room table, nibbling at a spoonful of James's strawberry ice cream.
"Don't you like it?"
Sally asked, readying to take my crystal dish.
"It's my favorite."
"It's delicious," I said, but could barely taste it for the maelstrom in my head and heart.
"Sally, you like ice cream too much,"
Polly said with a girlish laugh, her spoon clinking as she watched Sally round the table.
"You're getting as fat a belly as a pregnant lady. If you aren't careful, everyone will point and say, 'Enceinte.'"
"Polly, how unkind," I scolded, my gaze whipping up. But something about the comment drew my father's eyes to Sally's middle. I looked too, taking in the slight swell beneath the pink-ribboned belt of her flowing chemise gown. The moment might have passed without suspicion had Sally not spread her fingers over her belly like a fan and turned her amber gaze to my father in what looked to be heart-breaking desperation. My sister giggled, but Sally didn't laugh and neither did my father. Instead, they exchanged a stricken, naked look between them that resounded like a thunderclap. And my father flushed scarlet. A sound like honeybees buzzed in my ears as the horrific realization slowly made its way past my defenses to assault my reason. Sally was pregnant. And Papa wouldn't be sitting there burning with shame unless... No. That couldn't be. It couldn't be shame I saw on his countenance. Perhaps it was anger that Our Lady's maid had been seduced by some villain, or perhaps jealousy that pretty Sally had given herself to some low-bred delivery boy, or some stranger from the streets, or some visitor. I looked across the table at my father, searching for the truth, and under my scrutiny, he blanched. The scarlet color in his face drained suddenly away, leaving him in pale, bloodless mortification. Then I knew he wasn't jealous or angry. He was guilty. I tore my eyes away to spare us both the agony of acknowledging it. Close on the heels of my shock came a wave of anger and indignation. Here I'd been so tormented about wanting to be with William, because it would mean leaving Papa alone. And yet, Papa hadn't been alone at all. I clenched my fists beneath the table, which did nothing to still my hammering heart. And before I could compose myself or make any sense of my feelings, Papa shot up from the table, took Sally by the arm, and led her out. From just outside the dining room, their soft, intimate whispers sounded not meant for our ears. They were lovers having a quarrel, while my sister and I sat there, bewildered, our ice cream forgotten and melting. "Sally is going to have a baby?" Polly asked. "Hush!" I pressed my lips together and willed my little sister to silence. "But she doesn't have a husband. Will we have to send her to the convent?" We knew girls who had lost their virtue and been sent to the Panthéon in the hopes that the world would forget. Papa had always taught us to treat such girls kindly and to blame their error upon the wicked men who preyed upon the peculiar vulnerabilities of our sex. But Sally Hemings wasn't a gentlewoman of society with a family reputation to stain. Unless it was our family reputation. Sally was, well, she was a lady's maid and a chambermaid, who in France, where prostitutes openly roamed the Palais Royal, would judge her harshly. However, my father they would gleefully judge, for even I judged him. All the same anger and confusion and revulsion I felt the night I came upon them kissing roiled up inside me anew. Was it because Sally was a girl not even my own age, and he a much older man? Unions between older men and young women our age were not so unusual. Was it because Sally had the taint of African blood? She didn't seem tainted to me. Was it that Sally was my mother's sister and looked so much like her? Perhaps. Or was it, as William had once suggested, the evil of slavery that stained the Union and corrupted it even here, where Sally was ostensibly free? It was all these things and more. Deep, bitter resentment rushed through me at the realization that my father indulged his base inclinations while having contrived to separate me from the man I wanted. I sprang to my feet, as if to flee from the reality of it. But where could I go? Instead, I paced, feeling like I couldn't sit still or I might explode. "Say nothing more about it, Polly." "But nothing at all," I told her, reaching to give her a little shake. "We shouldn't add to Sally's burdens." Polly stared at me, her blue eyes swimming with confusion. The sister who came to us in France would never have obeyed. She'd have pestered me until her curiosity was satisfied. But in this one matter we were fortunate Polly's illness had made her into a more pliable creature, or at least one too weary to argue. But I didn't just want to silence Polly's questions out of consideration for Sally, nor so that I might have a better chance to overhear the conversation playing out just outside the room. I didn't want Polly to speak of it because I didn't want anyone to speak of it. Just beyond the doorway, my father reached to tug Sally close. I watched in fascination and horror as his hunger for her became crystal clear. How had I missed it and dismissed it as infatuation all this time? I'd told myself the wages and dresses and locket were some manner of apology for his ungentlemanly behavior. I'd been such a fool. How many times did their eyes lock across the table without my noticing? How often had they stolen away to... The memory of the kiss I'd witnessed long ago somehow transformed itself in my mind into two lust-fevered bodies upon my father's bed, tawny limbs tangled with pale freckled ones. I steadied myself on the back of a chair and shook the vision away. Then, outside the dining room, Sally pulled free of my father's desperate grasp, daring to turn her back on her master, and strode away, leaving Papa to bury his face in his hands. And I knew. He hadn't just gotten her with child. He had feelings for her, which meant as long as they were together, they'd create the opportunity for people to talk. I could already hear the mockery, the voice of American liberty who takes liberties with his enslaved maid. What could I possibly do to protect any of us from it? Truthfully, I was so angry, I wasn't sure I cared to try. Papa went straight away to bed that night without speaking a single solitary word to anyone. He stayed abed the next morning without soaking his feet in cold water, as was his daily habit. Upon waking, I found the unused basin of water just outside his chambers, and Polly said, "He won't take it unless Sally brings it to him, but she won't." I told myself I didn't care. I told myself to walk past his door and pretend that I didn't hear the silent echo of his suffering over the roar of my anger. But instead I knocked lightly, then turned the ornate knob and found nothing but darkness inside. The drapes were pulled closed, and not even a candle by his bedside lit the room. Papa's voice came throaty through the blackness. "Go, Patsy. You're letting in the light." I disobeyed, slipping into his solitary world with him and closing the door behind me. Then, filled with anger at him and shame for him, I dared to challenge Papa as I never had before. "Are you truly unwell?" Silence was my answer, and it stretched on so long that he needn't have replied at all. I understood his silence as humiliation. He'd hoped to carry on with Sally without being found out. Maybe that's why he'd wanted so desperately to send us back to Virginia, I thought resentfully.
"There is a terrible hammering in my head," he finally said in a voice that spoke of true pain. "I cannot begin to describe the agony."
Still skeptical, I made my way carefully to his bedside, sidestepping a round wooden table piled high with books. Was his agony caused by the headache or by the thought of losing his lover? Despite my anger, I'd seen the emotion on his face when he'd learned of Sally's condition. He cared for her, maybe even loved her. If he'd been worried about the idea of her remaining in the chaos of Paris before, how much worse might his fears be now that she carried his child? Pressing a hand to his forehead, I felt his skin warm and dry. There was no fever, but he groaned, as if my touch made it worse. He didn't leave his bed that day, nor could he leave it the next. Instead, he lay writhing on his mattress, put into torment by the slightest bit of light. He ate nothing, read nothing, and wanted to see no one but Sally. It echoed disturbingly of his pain over the loss of my mother. And yet, Sally would not come. I found her in the kitchen, and all but commanded her to go to him. But Sally stayed put, chopping onions the way her brother had taught us both to do, her eyes watering of it. And when I pressed her, we faced each other as if we were equals for the first time. Dropping her hand to her belly, she said, "I won't go to him until he lets me and the child free." So it was the explicit grant of freedom she was holding out for. She hadn't dared to demand freedom for herself when James did, but for her child, she'd found the courage to defy my father, to abandon him, to torment him even, for now there was no question that he was ill. So ill that I heard him retch on water. It was grief that had made him unable to open his eyes. Grief for how he'd tarnished his honor. An unwillingness to face a world in which he'd be vilified as a seducer of a girl in his charge, and the father of a mixed-race child he might never know if Sally left him to pursue life as a free woman. And I felt his naked fear of what might become of them on their own. 3 days my father lay in bed, shut up, alone, in despair. Then 4. Then 5. He called for me on the 6th. There, in the near blackness of his room, he twined my fingers with his and said,
"Patsy, let me tell you where King Louis went wrong. The King of France wants his people's love so badly that he crushes them in his embrace. He won't let them pursue happiness. He has to be forced to every compromise. I've seen enough tyrants in my time to learn from their mistakes. So I won't thwart the rebellion of the young people in my household, even if it means I must lose the love and comfort of those dearest to me. You and William, Sally and James."
With a gasp I said, "Papa, you can never lose our love." No matter what I thought about his relations with Sally, I loved my father dearly. So dearly that just as I'd hated Maria Causeway for rejecting my father, I now felt a festering resentment for Sally, too. It wasn't the same, of course. This wasn't Sally's fault. But she knew how my father was suffering, and she didn't need him to grant her freedom in France. She could take it, and he couldn't stop her. So why couldn't she at least offer him a kind word before she left us?
"I will lose you," my father said with a melancholy sigh. "It's the way of things, I know. I'm going out of life, and you're all coming in."
It horrified me to hear him say that he was going out of life. "Let me call for a doctor." Papa put his finger over my lips, as if just the sound of my voice pained him.
"I had this headache when your grandmother died. It's a penance that must be endured. It reminds me that I'm past the prime of my life and I must give way. The earth belongs to the living and your generation has more life left than mine. Though I'll be lost without you, I won't stand in the way of you and William, even if it means I'll lose what is most precious to me. When William asks for your hand, tell him yes with all your heart if that's your desire."
"Oh, Papa, you'll never lose me," I said, my heart filling with the bittersweet pain of happiness and gratitude, but also sorrow. Because though my father would never lose my love, if I married William, we'd never live together again. My father must have known it, which made it all the harder for him to let me go.
"But, Patsy, I would ask this kindness of you. Come back with me to Virginia to settle Polly and say your farewells before returning to France for the wedding."
I nodded, bringing his weak hand to my lips and kissing it over and over. But at my kisses, Papa turned his face back to the pillow, as if he felt himself unworthy of them.
Would you send Sally to me?"
I knew what it cost him to ask that of me, to ask me to fetch his mistress, the mother of his child, the woman he had plainly fallen in love with. His head, that is what he said ailed him. But it was his heart. How many times had I seen this before? The passionate heart he always forced to submit to his surpassing intellect. His heart, like all of France, was in rebellion against its ruler. And that's why he asked again so sheepishly for her.
"Tell her to come to me. Unlike King Louis, I'll treat fairly with her."
He meant to give her up too, then. Though he felt abandoned and unloved, he meant to give us all the freedom we desired. And I worried it would destroy him. Chapter 15. Paris, 17 July, 1789. From Thomas Jefferson to Thomas Paine.
A more dangerous scene of war I never saw in America than what Paris has presented for 5 days past.
The Bastille had fallen and Paris was aflame. Men had been beheaded, their corpses dragged before the mob, and tens of thousands of citizens now marched about with pistols, swords, pikes, pruning hooks, and scythes. The only hope of peace rested upon the shoulders of Lafayette, who had assumed command of the National Guard. And our tree was gone, the one William had carved. It had been smashed by cannon fire, or hacked to pieces by the hordes of angry citizens in the streets, I knew not which. And there I stood at the balcony window, staring down at its fractured stump, mesmerized by the violent destruction of something so dear to me, and the city in which it was born.
"Come away from the windows, Patsy,"
William urged, his voice strained with worry. I choked back a sob. "It's all torn apart. Everything is going wrong." William dared to fold me into his arms, saying again,
"Come away from the window. There is no telling with what violence the king's processional will be met."
I couldn't be made to budge. If there was violence, I would see it. I'd bear witness to it as I'd been witness to everything else. Like all of Paris, I was caught up in the spell of waiting, waiting for something to happen, not knowing if it would bring liberation or despair. William's eyes fell upon the ruin of our tree, and he held me tighter.
"We'll carve another tree."
Turning, I blurted, "I have to go back to Virginia."
"I know you're frightened."
"I'm not frightened," I said, which wasn't entirely true. But I feared my father's debilitated emotional state even more than the cannon fire we'd heard outside. I couldn't tell William about Sally's pregnancy. Unlike me, he was unlikely to be surprised to learn she'd gotten with child, and Sally's condition would soon be obvious to everyone. So why couldn't I tell him? It was the shame. William had once asked if we should object more to a man's affection for his slave than to the fact that he holds her in bondage. But it felt altogether objectionable, even though I somehow felt as if my father needed my protection more than ever. Which is why I bristled to hear William say,
"You cannot go back to Virginia with your father, Patsy."
"Papa has asked it of me. It's all he's asked of me."
"He'll never bring you back to France."
I stared at William, half forgetting to breathe. "Surely you aren't saying he won't keep his word?"
"He'll ask me to return to Virginia to fetch you,"
William said.
"I know he says that he'll finish out his term as minister in Paris, but your father will be offered a position to serve in America as a member of President Washington's cabinet."
This was nothing short of stunning news. "Who told you such a thing?"
"It was in a letter I read from Mr. Madison."
I fumbled for a reply, fumbled to understand what this meant for our future, or if there was a future for any of us in a city on fire. "Even if Papa is offered such a position, he won't accept it. He wants to retire from public life. You've heard him say it many times."
"And I wagered a beaver hat that Mr. Jefferson will refuse the appointment. But it's a bet I'm going to lose. I haven't the slightest doubt that your father will accept a cabinet position in the new government, no matter what he says to the contrary."
I gasped. "That's twice you've questioned my father's honor." The words came uneasily off my tongue, even though Papa's liaison with Sally had called his honor into question all on its own, and I knew it. You think he's lying when he says he wants to finish his work here and return to Monticello forevermore?
If he's lying, it's only to himself,
Mr. Short replied evenly.
Your father will let his friends persuade him because his mind's already made up. He's the only one who doesn't know it.
Heat came to my cheeks. I cannot agree.
Patsy, all the world thinks of your father as a man of cool temper. Some assume that because he dabbles in everything, he holds true passion for nothing. We know better. The abiding passion of his life is a government that derives its authority from the people. These past few months here in Paris, working to enlist France in the spirit of revolution, have you ever seen him more himself?
No, I whispered, for it was true. Even if government was not the only thing for which he held a passion. Not since my mother's death had my father been so alive. What part did Sally play in that? And what would happen to him when he accepted that she and the child were both lost to him? William continued, battering at my weak defenses.
We treat your father like a living monument, because he was born to do important work. You're his daughter, and he says I'm his adoptive son. But the American experiment is the child he birthed and will never abandon. So he can wax prosaic about the joys of private domesticity on his mountain top all day, but in the end, he'll join the president's cabinet, and he won't return to Paris with or without you.
You're just impatient for us to be together, I said, desperate to deny it all. Almost as desperate as the people on the streets below, anxious for the answer of their king. We've waited this long, and you don't want to wait any longer. But this is all my father asks of me, to return with him to Virginia and settle Polly there before marrying you.
And all I'm asking of you is not to go.
I'd loved William all my life, but never had I been angrier with him. As shouts from the crowd rose up to our window, I said, "That's not all you're asking of me. You want me to give up my father, my sister, and my country. You're asking all these things of me, but all I'm asking of you is to wait for me to return." It seemed to me to be a perfectly reasonable argument, one that might have persuaded a man in love, even a man as stubborn as William Short. But his chin jutted out willfully.
I'm 30 years old, Patsy, and what do I have to show for it? No career, no wife, no fortune. I have done everything your father has asked of me save return to Virginia, and still he would keep us apart. Still, I am lectured to by your father as if I were a boy. And maybe he thinks it right because when he was my age, your father was building Monticello. Already had a wife and child. Had already written a summary view of the rights of British America.
You can't compare yourself to my father. His eyes narrowed with something that looked like disappointment, and he shook his head.
All my friends have said you're still too young.
What friends say that? I snapped, anger boiling now.
That's not important. What's important is that you can be a wife and mother, or you can be a devoted daughter all your life. You can't be both. Not when Thomas Jefferson is your father. You have to choose, Patsy.
His words echoed the very debates that I'd been having with myself for weeks, and that horrified me, because he was saying that I couldn't have them both. You're asking me to choose you over everything else and blaming him for it. My voice cracked. My papa isn't asking me to choose, but you are. William didn't even lower his eyes at my rebuke.
You're right. I am. If you go to Virginia, 2 months will become six. 6 will become a year. We'll never be together. So if you leave France, know that I won't be waiting.
Just then, the trumpets blared to announce the king's procession, and we fell silent, watching the street below, mesmerized by the sight of the surging crowd, not knowing if it would come to open war then and there. The people wanted their freedom. They strained for it, were willing to fight for it in bloody struggle. But like a father of the nation, the king had come to Paris to restore order. And between these two forces, between the carriage of the king and his people, was caught the Marquis de Lafayette. In proud uniform, a cockade of red, white, and blue, just like the one I wore pinned to my own gown, he rode at the head of the processional. It required courage and honor in its rawest form to ride as he did, defending the very king whose authority he sought to strip away against an armed mob with whom his heart belonged. And my eyes filled with tears at the thought that Lafayette might falter and be torn to pieces by the crowd. I didn't brush those tears away as Lafayette's horse passed under our window, and though he rode in a crowd of thousands, he looked up at me. I imagined that our eyes met, that I saw in Lafayette's white-faced grimness an acceptance of his fate so long as he never betrayed his cause. Then he bowed to me, and I knew I had not imagined it. He bowed to me, and his honor and courage became my own. The spark of his devotion lit a fire inside me that burned away my doubts. My hand fell away from William's grasp, and my voice no longer wavered. I'm going to Virginia with my father, and if you love me, you'll wait for me a little longer. Our trunks were packed, and I took a last look at the inventory list of books, busts, pictures, and clocks to be shipped ahead of us. The Hotel de Langeac was strangely bare and quiet, and I kept hoping, hoping desperately for William. No matter how angry he was at my leaving, surely he'd see us off. I lingered near the door, jumping up at the sound of every passing carriage in the street, expecting him until almost the last moment. I think it was the excruciating fear that William might truly let this be the end of it between us that left me so confused to see Sally in the foyer with her own satchel of belongings. All she owns in the world, I thought. I was moved by her plight, not only because I was fond of her, or even only because she was, in the way of the Hemingses, near kin to me, but also because the truth of our situation was leaking around all the barricades I'd put up against it. Inside her, she carried my little brother or sister, one I could never acknowledge and might never see born. At least the baby would be born in France, born free. That heartened me. And seeing glimpses of pain and anxiety in her amber eyes, my heart went out to her. The warmth of sympathy and concern a welcome balm from the cold ache of William's absence. You won't become destitute, I promised with a small smile, twisting the ring Papa bought me from my finger and pressing it into her hand. You keep this for a day you need it, but you won't. I'll send a letter to Marie and Madame de Tessay and the Duchess Rosalie to find a place for you as a lady's maid. Until then, why not stay on here at the Hotel de Langeac? Mr. Short won't put you out in the street.
James and I are going home with you to Virginia, Sally said, stunning me into silence. Your papa has made us an offer.
My throat tightened. What offer could he have made them? Though they were his slaves,
The Hemingses had the laws of France on their side, not to mention the laws of God. And I found it hard to imagine my dignified father bargaining with any slave, much less his own. But then Sally convinced me. We've been negotiating a treaty. A treaty? That did sound like my father, the minister to France. I could easily imagine him condescending to charm his enslaved lover, giving her the courtesies due an ambassador from a foreign land. Oh, I managed, bewildered. She lifted her chin, a hint of pride there. Your father promises that if James goes back and teaches someone else all he's learned in the kitchens of Paris, he'll go free. And if I go back, your father will keep me and care for me well till his death. He'll free my babies, too, when they turn 21, upon his solemn oath. Babies, as if there would be more, as if they meant to carry on indefinitely. I nearly slapped her. My anger was so volcanic that it burned coherent thought from my mind. I wasn't even sure why I was so angry, only that I was. You want to be a slave all your life, Sally? Past my strangled fury, I choked out. You want to be my father's whore? She brushed the wetness of her eyes away, as if it pained her for me to see her cry. How am I to leave my family in Virginia, Miss Patsy? Never see my mama again? Knowing your father wants me, how could I refuse? He's good to me, and I hate nothing like disappointing him. It hurts to disappoint him. Who knew the truth of that statement better than I did? And yet I stood there, shaken with a fury at her choice that I couldn't comprehend, biting the insides of my cheeks to keep from howling with it. It was the wrong choice. Could she not see it? You're giving up your freedom. I know it. Her chest heaved with emotion beneath her pretty blue gown. But women have to give hard thought to the men we'll wind up with. Make a mistake and get a drunk, a spendthrift, a cruel man, a man who won't keep his word. But your papa gives his word and nobody ever doubts it. You think I'm likely to find some better Frenchman? Or some better man at all? Or any man willing to have a woman carrying another man's baby? Sally's shoulders fell, and just for a moment, sympathy pierced my anger. She'd be with child in a city full of upheaval, with no one to rely upon but her brother. But then she said, "In marriage, man and woman become one, and that one is a husband." Did she think of herself as my father's wife? The very thought of it sent fire through my blood anew and made sense of my rage. She believed that what passed between her and my father was a lifelong sacrament when it was nothing but sin. And while I stood there, wondering how to tell her that she'd never replace my mother, she straightened her shoulders and said, "He loves me, Miss Patsy." I did slap her then. Sally shrieked and clutched her cheek. But I wasn't moved to pity. I'd given up William to save my father from dying of a broken heart, thinking that Sally was going to leave him and take his child with her. Was my whole life in ruin because of this girl? My rage grew even harder toward my father. For his words about William's fitness and his melancholy about Sally had brought me to the conclusion that I must give up what I wanted for myself and do my duty. And yet all the while, Papa was making deals to ensure he'd make no sacrifice at all. Not now, and very likely not in the future. Not as long as Sally chose to remain at his side. In my mind's eye, I saw him on his knees before me, reaffirming his deathbed promise never to take another wife, and pleading that his happiness depended on me, all to keep me from taking my vows. And now I'd given up
everything I'd ever dared to want for myself. The convent, William, everything. The room spun around me, and pressure built inside me that demanded release. I felt less in control of myself than ever before or at any time after. And so I did something that to this day I regret even more than slapping her. I hissed in her tear-streaked face what I knew to be a lie. Papa doesn't love you, and he never will. I've made a mistake, I thought, imagining I could see England across the fog-covered waters of the Channel. There was still time to turn back. I could run back to William Short's embrace and beg a thousand pardons for having left him. My father wouldn't stop me, not when he knew his honor was so tarnished in my eyes. Indeed, it seemed as if nature herself commanded me to turn back, because the bumpy earth had split the axle of our phaeton and broken the wheels of our carriage to slow us down. Then the most tempestuous weather we'd ever seen trapped us with a storm of wind and squall, the fury of which was an echo of all the turmoil inside me. But William hadn't tried to stop me from going. He'd never even said goodbye. And so this was an ending, I told myself. Turning away from the view, I knew I couldn't look back. But neither could I go forward, for this storm blew for 9 days, until the only way Papa could calm my little sister was to promise her a puppy. Papa said, "Come search out shepherd dogs with me, Patsy." "Why don't you take your lover?" I let the silent question show in my sullen eyes. Then, furiously, I grabbed my coat with an insolent stare. Numb with heartbreak, I scarcely felt the chill of the rain or the blow of the wind when we went clambering the cliffs. Though Papa tried to engage me in conversation, I said next to nothing as we walked together for hours, nearly 10 miles in all. It was a fruitless, awkward search. I had too much dignity to pretend there was nothing wrong between us. My father knew what weighed upon my heart, and I knew what weighed upon his. And at long last, I decided that if we were going to quarrel, why not do it here in the howling wind? When we neared the docks, I opened my mouth to reprimand him for his immoral conduct with Sally and for putting a wedge between William and me. But just as I inhaled to speak the words, we heard a crack sharper than thunder. Hearts hammering, we turned to see a man collapse upon the beach. My father rushed closer, demanding I stay back, but fear carried my feet forward. It was the most ghastly sight I've ever witnessed, the body of a man who had, just that moment, shot himself. His pistol had dropped at his feet and he'd fallen backward. The blast completely separated his whole face from the forehead to the chin, pounding it to a bloody pulp. And the center of his head was entirely laid bare, red blood, white bone, and blue-gray brain. Who this dead, mangled man was, or what had caused his anguish, was something I was destined never to know. For my father took me at once in his arms and turned me away from the sight, cradling me against his chest while the rain and hot tears mingled on my cheeks. As I sobbed, my father shielded me from the horror and pulled me from it. When we'd stumbled some distance away, he clutched me tightly. "Oh, Patsy, would that you had never seen it. Forgive me." He murmured the sentiment over and over, the tempest hiding the words from everyone except me until I was sure he wasn't speaking only of the dead man, because despite the dreadful shock of the suicide we'd witnessed and the reminder of my father's own brush with pistols so long ago, I knew Papa's grief came from someplace much deeper. His pain made the lingering doubts about the choice I'd made fly away. I couldn't have abandoned my father. Neither for William Short nor for God could I have ever chosen a life away from Papa. The country he'd founded, the land he loved, needed him, and he needed me. If William had ever truly loved me, this was something he should have known and understood. 2 days before Christmas, as we rolled up to the foot of our mountain with carts filled with French treasures, Papa's black field hands and lighter-colored house slaves collected in crowds to greet us. Dressed in their best church clothes, they almost drew the carriage up the mountain by hand. When the door of the carriage was opened, they received their master in their arms and bore him to the house, crowding round and kissing his hands, some crying, others laughing. It seemed impossible to satisfy their anxiety to touch and kiss the very earth that bore him. They lifted him up into the biting air against his wishes, carrying him to the house while James helped me and Polly and Sally down from the carriage. And in spite of being so heavy with child, once Sally got down, she ran into the arms of her mother. What did Sally's mother think, to see her children return from France when they might have been free? The Hemingses were all too careful to let such emotions play freely on their faces, but I wondered if Sally's mother was secretly furious or proud that her daughter was now the master's mistress. "Oh, Miss Patsy," Mammy Ursula exclaimed tearfully as she took in my elegant French dress and my pristine traveling gloves. "Look at the lady you've become. We've missed you so very much." "I've missed you, too," I said, a sudden tightness in my throat. Standing here again seemed almost a dream, and my heart swelled with affection and ached with guilt for having been gone for so long. The lives of Papa's people had been uncertain, at the mercy of those he put over them. They must have wondered if we'd forgotten them, if they'd be ripped away from each other and sold off like farm animals, and because of my father's financial difficulties, we couldn't even promise it wouldn't happen. "Now come in and we'll get you settled," Mammy insisted, leading me up the stairs into the house. That's when I realized that the neoclassical double porticoed plantation manor of my childhood was in shambles. Peeling paint, warped wood, crumbling stairs, looming over a row of slave cabins in much better repair, the once lovely mansion looked like it might fall off its pillars.
"Mon Dieu!"
whispered Polly, who had no memory of the house as it was. I could guess at her thoughts. This was Papa's idyllic mountaintop refuge he boasted of so often. After an absence of 6 years, perhaps the dilapidated condition of the house was to be expected, but it very much gave the impression that we'd come down in the world. And inside was worse. We stepped past tops that covered holes stripped down to the brick for renovations barely started and never finished. We'd have no indoor plumbing, as we'd enjoyed at the Hôtel de l'Angiac. The furniture was moth-eaten. Not much had been made in the way of provisions, either. We lacked for bedding, candles, coffee, and firewood. It was almost Christmas, and there was already a bite in the air. How were we to keep warm? Thankfully, I was mostly numb to the cold. A little bit numb to everything, really, since the day I left William Short. Or, to be more precise, since the day he told me he would not wait for me. Because our journey had been slowed with visits to friends and family along the way, I'd let myself believe that I'd return to Monticello to find a letter from William, a tearful letter reassuring me that all was not ended, maybe even one that pleaded with me to return to him on the fastest ship I could find, But there were no letters from William Short waiting at Monticello. Not for me, not even for my father. William couldn't spare a scrap of paper or a blot of ink for either of us. And all hopes were dashed that the breach between us might ever be mended. I wasn't as practiced at reading William's silences as my father's, but the finality of it came crashing down around me, smashing my heart to pieces. He wasn't going to forgive me. He wasn't going to wait for me. He was done with me forever. I'd made that choice, an irrevocable choice. How would I ever make peace with it? Chapter 16. Monticello, 2nd April, 1790. From Thomas Jefferson to Madame de Corny.
My daughter, on her arrival in Virginia, received the addresses of a young Mr. Randolph, the son of a bosom friend of mine. Though his talents, dispositions, connections, and fortune would have made him my own first choice, according to the usage of my country, I scrupulously suppressed my wishes so that my daughter might indulge her own sentiments freely.
That is not, of course, the way I remember it.
I've invited Tom Randolph to join us at Christmas,
Papa announced as we took tea in our dilapidated parlor. One glance provided proof that our house was in no condition to receive visitors, but I protested because I wanted to be alone with my secret agonies. More importantly, I couldn't bear visitors seeing Sally afforded deference by all the slaves at Monticello. Of course, I said none of this to Papa, who continued,
"I intend to take your cousin Tom under my wing. He excelled in his studies at Edinburgh. With guidance, he could be one of the great men of the next generation. Besides, Patsy, I should think you'd welcome his company. He's no blockhead, and as the heir presumptive to Tuckahoe, Tom's the most eligible bachelor amongst the Virginia gentry."
I couldn't find a reply. Why should I care about the eligibility of the gangly and exceedingly maddening boy who'd taunted me in my youth? But I knew exactly why Papa thought I should care. After the drama in Paris, William Short had made no proposal of marriage. Whereas I was heartbroken at William's silence, my father was furious at William's apparent break with us and failure to update him on the revolution, considering that he'd entrusted to his young protégé our American mission in France. Papa felt betrayed, I think. Perhaps in Tom Randolph he was seeking a new adoptive son.
"I've invited the Carr brothers, too,"
Papa said to put my mind at ease.
"Trust me, Patsy, the season will be much merrier in the company of your cousins."
I couldn't begin to see how. But for all of Papa's insistence that he suppressed his feelings, when Tom came riding up our drive on Christmas morn, Papa quite nearly pushed me out the door to greet him. And I'll say this for Tom, even from the distance of all these years, staring at the smudged and yellowed letter in my hand, I can still remember the way my breath caught at the sight of him on that horse. Tom Randolph rode like a demon, his broad shoulders and strong arms exerting expert control over the animal beneath him. He was all athletic grace when he swung down from his saddle in a swirl of black cloak, and his boots landed with a splash in the mud. He stood a good deal taller than even my father, so he had to bend his head to acknowledge me. His dark, savage eyes took in my gown, and he drawled, "Well, I do declare, Miss Jefferson, you've turned into a Frenchwoman." Given his unsmiling expression, I couldn't tell if he meant it as a compliment or an insult, and truthfully, I didn't care. With jet black hair and skin of an olive hue, he'd grown to be, without a doubt, the most handsome man I'd met on any continent. He was beautiful to behold in the way of artwork, and more striking in plain riding clothes than a nobleman in satin and lace.